From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
These organizations really stretch all the way back to the beginning of the country. And I don't try to go all the way back to the beginning, but I start with the 1880s because I think at that point in time, there was some new ideas about how to build organizations. Mm-hmm. And some of those ideas that T. Thomas Fortune, who is a very important African-American journalist, right, and sort of a political theorist and really deep thinker. And he started thinking about, we need an organization that's going to be national, that's not going to be political. It's not going to be tied to either political party, but it's going to work on racial justice issues and it's going to coordinate what's going on in all these regional efforts and all these local efforts, but we need a national umbrella. And so that was his idea for the Afro-American League. And so I start there because I think that's kind of a new generation of organizations.
Professor Susan D. Carl, professor of law at American University and author of Defining the Struggle, National Organizing for Racial Justice, 1880 to 1915, published by Oxford University Press. Defining the Struggle uncovers the forgotten contributions of the late 19th century and early 20th century national organizations, including the National Afro-American League, the National Afro-American Council, the National Association for Colored Women's Clubs, and the Niagara Movement, in developing strategies for racial justice organizing, which they passed on to the NAACP and the National Urban League. It tells the story of these organizations' leaders and motivation, the initiative they undertook, and the ideas about law and racial justice activism they developed and passed on to future generations. In doing so, it sheds new light on how these early origins helped set the path for 20th century legal civil rights activism in this country. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Defining the Struggle, with law professor and author Susan D. Carl, In Black America.
Women were really important, and I hope I really make that clear in the book. And even the organizations like the Afro-American League and the Afro-American Council had women members and women leaders. So women had very important leadership roles in both of those organizations. And they were very active, of course, in fundraising, grassroots turnout, activism, nurturing new members, and all of that kind of thing. So they were very, very important there. But they were also important in their own organization, the NACW, as I was saying, in kind of articulating a vision of how working on political and civil rights issues, which the NACW did do. It had a platform that included civil rights and political demands and issues, very much, very similar to the Afro-American Council, very, very similar. In fact, I think T. Thomas Fortune was involved in drafting those platforms for both organizations, so you can see real similarities.
Since its founding in 1910, the same year as another national organization devoted to economic and social welfare aspects of racial advancement, the National Urban League and the NAACP has been viewed as the vanguard national civil rights organizations in American history. But these two flagship institutions were not the first important national organizations devoted to advancing the cause of racial justice. Instead, it was even earlier groups, including the National Afro-American League, the National Afro-American Council, the National Association of Colored Women, and the Niagara Movement, that developed and transmitted to the NAACP and the National Urban League foundational ideas about law and lawyering that these latter organizations would then pursue. Susan D. Carl's Defining the Struggle explores the forerunning organizations whose contribution in shaping early 20th century national civil rights organizing has largely been forgotten today.
I had been doing some writing about the early NAACP, and I could tell from the research that I was doing that all these ideas they had about test case litigation, you know, finding a law that needed to be challenged and then basically creating the facts, staging the facts in order to challenge the law, which I thought was a really interesting technique, legal technique. And I was researching that. And then I could tell that the ideas were not new ideas. And I knew the story always was, well, the NAACP invented all these new ideas. So I started to probe where the ideas came from. And for a long time, I didn't really know I was going to end up putting it all together in a book. I was just interested in researching it. But then the more I researched it, the more I felt like it was a story that needed to be told. And so I ended up putting together my research to write a book.
We can not go through the plethora of information in this book, but I did highlight some areas in which I wanted to address during our conversation. Give us an idea of some of the first organization that dealt with racial injustices in this country.
Well, these organizations really stretch all the way back to the beginning of the country. And I don't try to go all the way back to the beginning, but I start with the 1880s because I think at that point in time, there was some new ideas about how to build organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those ideas that T. Thomas Fortune, who was a very important African-American journalist,
right,
and sort of a political theorist and really deep thinker, and he started thinking about, we need an organization that's going to be national, that's not going to be political, it's not going to be tied to either political party, but it's going to work on racial justice issues and it's going to coordinate what's going on in all these regional efforts and all these local efforts, but we need a national umbrella. And so that was his idea for the Afro-American League. And so I start there because I think that's kind of a new generation of organizations. The idea for that gets started with him in the 1880s.
Give us an idea, what was conditions like for African Americans back in 1877 up through 1880s?
Yeah, so this is the end of Reconstruction. This is the federal government, the U.S. government has pulled out of the South, pulled its troops out of the South, and the country is going through a period of terrible backsliding on mm-hmm. race justice issues. This is the beginning of what's called historians call the nadir period, meaning the absolute worst
right.
that race relations were after the end of slavery. And lynchings are common throughout the South, border states. There's violence going on, even in the North, or especially in the North, there's labor-related racial violence targeted against African-American workers. The states, Southern states, are passing laws that prohibit African Americans and whites from riding together in streetcars and railroad cars. So you're seeing sort of the law coming in to really enforce racism and segregation in public accommodations, libraries, public facilities, private facilities. The employment opportunities for African Americans are getting worse as employers are succumbing to pressure, a lot of it from labor unions, to stop hiring African Americans. So it's a period in which education is not improving, again, because there's not funding from the government and because of segregation in lower and higher education. So it's a period of really kind of the worst conditions you can imagine. And it's in this period that these organizations get started, which is kind of contrary to some of what political science theory says. Political science theory says organizations get started when things get a little better. But here things are getting worse, but still we see national organizing getting started.
Tell us about the National Afro-American Council.
Well, the National Afro-American Council comes after the National Afro-American League.
Right.
And T. Thomas Fortune's idea, he was very good at the vision part of organizing an organization, not quite as good at the day-to-day part. Plus, it was a new idea. So it's not surprising that the Afro-American League only lasted a few years, but it still had articulated a lot of ideas that ended up being the basis for the NAACP, three decades later. But after the Afro-American League collapses and conditions are getting worse, another really bad condition that I forgot to mention is disfranchisement, where Southern
right.
states are enacting legislation that prohibits African-American men from voting. So you've got all of this going on, and a number of people, including Bishop Alexander Walters, who's from the AME Zion Church, they go back to T. Thomas Fortune and they say, we need to start a new national organization. We need to respond to this wave of lynchings and disfranchisement and statutes that are explicitly segregating the country with another national effort. And so they get together and they form a new organization, which they call the Afro-American Council. And they try to make that organization somewhat different from the Afro-American League. T. Thomas Fortune is kind of he's pretty radical. He's pretty progressive or left wing.
Right.
And he only attracts people with that kind of who are kind of sympathetic to sort of more progressive or left-leaning politics. But what Bishop Walters tries to do with the Afro-American Council is to make it a very broad umbrella so that everybody who is interested in working on racial justice issues, whether they're conservative or sort of moderate or more on the left, everybody can work together under one umbrella. So it has a kind of a different character than the Afro-American League. It's bigger. Almost every prominent spokesperson or national leader or local leader is involved in some way. So it's a bigger effort, and it's also more financially solvent for a much longer period.
I understand. How did Howard University play in the organizing of these national organizations?
Howard University was so important. I focus on it. I'm sure it's not the only really important institution, but it's a very important one. And since I'm in Washington, D.C., and I had access to lots of archival records from Moreland Spingarn Research Center, which is a wonderful resource, right, I was able to really drill down into how many of these early activists graduated from Howard University, especially from Howard University Law School. So most of, not most of, but a large number of especially law-trained African-American male activists graduated from Howard's Law School. And they learned there from John Langston sort of a civil rights jurisprudence that motivated the work that they were doing.
Why was it so difficult when these organizations were having test cases besides financing them, but finding the legal wherewithal to move them forward?
Well, it was hard because, first of all, the judicial system was not sympathetic at all to civil rights claims. Mm-hmm. And so even though the lawyers who were bringing these claims, they deeply believed in the founding principles of the country, in the principles of equality of citizenship that are articulated in the Declaration of Independence and in the Reconstruction era amendments to the Constitution. So the deep principles of law were just, but the way that the courts were acting in this time period, they were ignoring and evading and rejecting these principles. So even though it was kind of clear that these cases weren't going to win, the early test cases, many of them did not succeed, but still as a strategy for political activism, these activists said to themselves and said to the country, we are going to make these claims because they are just and right, and we are going to put them forth in public for people to hear about. And if these courts reject them, then it's an embarrassment to the country. And they were also hoping that internationally people would be paying attention to what was happening. And so they saw this as a forum for political activism, but they never really believed that it would be easy, that just merely filing cases in court would solve the problems. And I think some historians later on kind of got that part of the story wrong. They kind of believed so much in the court system to fix things. But the activists in the time period I'm writing about, they were not naive. They were far too sophisticated to ever think that just filing a case in court would solve the nation's problems.
Yeah, no, that's right. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Professor Susan D. Carl, professor of law at American University, and author of Defining the Struggle, National Organizing for Racial Justice, 1880 to 1915. I found it interesting, the dichotomy between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington.
Yes. Yes. And of course, we know that they did not get along on a personal level. And so the history sort of is there to describe some of that. But looking into it, I thought that their disputes were very interesting and more nuanced than we sometimes remember them,
right,
in the sense that they actually agreed on a whole lot of things. They all agreed that economic advancement was important. They all agreed in education, about education to some extent. But Booker T. Washington, really, his fundamental economic philosophy was one of partnering with white capitalists,
mm-hmm,
and moving the community together that way. And Du Bois, of course, was developing much more radical viewpoints. And so he really wanted, he thought the relevant, important alliance was with the working class or with the labor movement. So they really disagreed on sort of underlying political ideologies. And I think that fueled a lot of their disputes and their debates.
Tell us about Du Bois' involvement with the Niagara movement.
Well, Du Bois was the key founder of the Niagara Movement, along with a few other people. And he founded the Niagara Movement. It grew out of the Afro-American Council, and it was a group of the more radical members of the Afro-American Council, and they tried very hard to work within the Afro-American Council for a long time. But because they distrusted Booker T. Washington and they felt he was dominating the council too much, they eventually decided to leave and form their own organization, and they call that the Niagara Movement because it was founded in near Niagara Falls, up on the border between the United States and Canada. And in fact, the first meeting was in Canada. And Du Bois was hoping the Niagara Movement would be a more pure and radical and sort of insistent organization. He wanted it to address, he went back to some of the ideas that T. Thomas Fortune had for the Afro-American League, though at this point T. Thomas Fortune is no longer part of the radical group. But Du Bois wanted to work on economic issues. He wanted to work on civil rights issues. He wanted to do everything all at once. And so he founded an organization that would sort of take on all of these issues. And it was a period where there's a lot of distrust. And so it was very secretive about who was members, and he wouldn't let everyone be members, including women. He excluded women initially from membership of the Niagara Movement. And it moved a long way towards what the NAACP would become. And it actually provided most of the leadership and the membership for the early NAACP. But Du Bois, in the end, he couldn't keep that particular organization going. And so he ends up joining the efforts to found the NAACP instead. But a lot of the ideas that the NAACP starts with come directly from the Niagara Movement.
For all the good that Booker T. Washington did secretly and above board, he also had a ruthless side to him.
He did. He really did. And it's understandable. It's understandable, but I think it's something that needs to be mentioned,
right,
that he didn't like his opponents, and he, in order to keep people in line and sort of all marching the way he wanted them marching, he would do quite ruthless things to people who disagreed with him or people that he felt were his political enemies. He would try to get them fired. He would spread rumors about them. He would pass information to white newspapers about their activities in ways that could even jeopardize them, their physical safety. So you really didn't want to be on the bad side of Booker T. Washington. And the fact that the Niagara Movement members joined that explicitly anti-Washington organization, knowing that they were really risking their careers in doing that, as I say in the book, that was really an act of real bravery to stand up for what they believed was right, even though they knew they were risking their careers and their well-being by doing that.
I understand. I found it interesting. One of the successful test cases that was won was Carter v. Texas, when it had to do with a violation of the 14th Amendment.
Yes. Yes. Now, there is one successful test case out of many that weren't. And this case was filed by a lawyer named Wilfred Smith. And Wilfred Smith was a brilliant Supreme Court strategist, African-American lawyer who had practiced in Galveston, Texas. And he
right.
came to Booker T. Washington's attention because he was doing such great litigation and winning cases that seemed unwinnable. And so Booker T. Washington paid him, actually, to bring a test case challenging Alabama's disfranchisement laws. And he didn't win all of it, but he won part of it. And it was, again, a really important step forward by a lawyer that we really, most people don't know who Wilfred Smith is. And even in law schools, people don't remember
right.
him at all. And so it's another example of some forgotten history that's important to resurrect.
Tell us about Mary Church Terrell and the National Association for Colored Women.
Yes, I think that talking about the NACW and including the work that they were doing as part of this early civil rights strategy is really important. And sometimes civil rights historians write just about the legal part. They just say, well, it's just about the law, the test cases and the lawyers, and what the women's reform organizations were doing. That was something else. That was just welfare work or social welfare work or, helping individuals in distress. But really, Church Terrell and the NACW had a very sophisticated and subtle strategy, which was to kind of work at the intersections of law and charity and voluntary work and try to move the boundaries between what was public responsibility and what was the responsibility of private charities. So they were doing a lot of very interesting experimentalist work in terms of building an alternative social welfare state in African American communities, and that work was really important to social reform efforts. So I spend a good part of the book writing about that as well, and suggesting that really when we talk about civil rights history, we have to look with a much broader lens to see all of this work and how it all interconnected.
You mentioned five or six individuals throughout the book that you build the narrative around. Why were these individuals that you selected important, but you did note that there were others who also had a significant contribution?
Yes, I put that early chapter in, and of course it's T. Thomas Fortune and Mary Church Terrell and Reverdy Ransom, Mary White Ovington, and William Buckley, who was an educator in New York City. And I picked them because I thought they were all really interesting, and their lives were interesting, and they were all very different from each other, and their work, I was trying to help show how the work of many different people coming from very different places fit together. They are all, I think, understudied individuals, people who we don't know enough about, and they all also had leadership roles in the organizations that I was going to write about, and most of them had leadership roles in two or even more organizations. So I was trying to write a book that would be interesting to people and to include the human stories as well as sort of the organizational analysis. And I tried to use that chapter to bring people into the story a little bit more. So I hope it worked.
It did.
So, good.
Let's go back to Church Terrell. Although she was interested in women's suffrage and the movement alone, but she's also was a great benefactor for her husband.
She was, and she worked in real partnership with him. She did, and I think that they had a very egalitarian relationship, and she helped him, and he helped her, and together they both advanced each other's sort of political stature a lot. So it was an example of an egalitarian marriage, and I think, you know, they were both really important, interesting activists.
When you look at the National Urban League and the NAACP, can you put your finger on a couple of founding principles and ideas that they galvanized around when they formed themselves?
Yes, and I write about their formation, and I think an interesting aspect of their founding, they were founded right around the same time, right around 1910, and you can date it different ways depending on what you take as the founding moment for the two organizations. And it's interesting, a lot of the same people were involved in both organizations, and they were kind of thinking strategically, and they wanted to, Booker T. Washington had really good relationships with a lot of very wealthy white philanthropists. And they had a lot of money to donate, and they wanted to donate money to race justice, race advancement issues, but they were scared of the radicals. So the National Urban League kind of founded as an organization that would work on social and economic advancement, but they weren't as focused on courts and litigation and demanding rights. And they actually did a lot better job than the early NAACP did in being able to raise money. And then there was another organization called the NAACP, and that organization was founded to work on the legal and civil rights aspects of advancing racial justice, and to do that through the courts and through litigation and through statutes and that kind of thing. And the people that, and it had a much more sort of militant profile, a more insistent profile. They weren't exactly militants in the way we think of militants today, but they were more demanding and insistent about civil rights issues, and that could attract the radicals without scaring off the philanthropists. So it was a really smart strategy. It was very pragmatic. It wasn't really because anybody thought these two areas were really analytically different, but this way they could raise more money and they could work on a broader range of issues.
In your opinion, how has history judged Du Bois' talented 10th model of organizing?
Well, Du Bois used the talented 10th idea. That was his Niagara Movement vision. His idea was, we're going to take the top 10% of professionally successful members of the race, all men, and they will lead the race in, you know, carving the path forward for racial justice. And I think even Du Bois learned through the Niagara Movement experience that that wasn't the right strategy, and that the right strategy was to include everybody, and that everybody had something to give, that working class people were also smart and dedicated and committed and would stick with it and needed to turn out in mass numbers in order to insist on civil rights gains. So I think that model really fell away, but it was the model everybody had. He wasn't unique in it. You know, it was sort of the model of progressives, white and black progressives at the time, which was to really believe that class status mattered to, you know, your reputation or who you were or what you had to contribute. And that idea fell away as the 20th century dawned. And so I think that model is dead, thankfully.
I understand. Some of the organizations that you profiled in your work excluded women. But one organization, and we spoke to that earlier, the National Association for Colored Women, has been somewhat unappreciated as an organization that worked for political reform. How did these women contribute to the foundational organizations?
Well, women were really important, and I hope I really make that clear in the book. And even the organizations like the Afro-American League and the Afro-American Council had women members and women leaders. So women had very important leadership roles in both of those organizations, and they were very active, of course, in fundraising, grassroots turnout, activism, nurturing new members, and all of that kind of thing. So they were very, very important there. But they were also important in their own organization, the NACW, as I was saying, in kind of articulating a vision of how working on political and civil rights issues, which the NACW did do. It had a platform that included civil rights and political demands and issues, very much, very similar to the Afro-American Council, very, very similar. In fact, I think T. Thomas Fortune was involved in drafting those platforms for both organizations, so you can see real similarities. But they also had a model of everybody in every local organization, find some way to improve your community. We're not going to tell you what to do. You can do a whole lot of different things. So their motto was unity and diversity. You know, you can do small-scale things. You can do big things. You can do political things. You can do things that are more about helping people in need.
Susan D. Kyle, professor of law at American University and author of Defining the Struggle. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.